This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The coronavirus pandemic certainly has had an impact on not only our lives, but also our political beings as well, too, if you want to call them that. An impact certainly on the races for governor and other races here in Northwest Indiana and across the Hoosier State. Andy Downs is the director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University Fort Wayne, and he is with us. Although I'm not sure, Andy, if you can make much sense out of it all, but we can certainly talk about it, I suppose.
We certainly can.
Well, thanks for being with us on Regionally Speaking today, and bring us up to date on how certainly the pandemic, but just things in general, have been for all the people in particular that are the candidates that are out there wishing to either stay in office or to achieve higher office.
I think there are really two ways to think about how this has affected campaigns, regardless of the quality of the campaign, who's running their party, regardless of all of that stuff. The two things to really keep in mind is the ability to raise money and the ability to have contact with voters. Obviously, for a lot of campaigns, what they hope to do is grassroots work. They want to be out knocking on doors and having small gatherings and large gatherings. Those are both very difficult to do right now, which means they then have to rely on other means of voter contact, like direct mail and television, radio, et cetera. And for that, you need money. But for a lot of folks, raising money right now is incredibly challenging because of the way the economy has slowed down. We're now in a recession. And also the other ways in which people can invest in their community. In a normal year, election year, candidates could actually pitch to their potential donors, make an investment in me. You like what I want to do with government, make an investment in me. But right now, with high unemployment, with people looking for ways to help and needing help, people are able to say, you know what, I'm going to give my money to this community foundation or to this charity, or I'm going to make a large number of purchases from restaurants and over tip when the food shows up, or tip high when the food shows up, because that's how I'm going to help out. It really is a challenging time to be campaigning.
It's challenging for folks that don't have the money to be able to do all those things that you mentioned that you want to do. And I'm sure that has to be factored into the issues that the candidates are having in trying to raise money for their campaigns.
Oh, absolutely. Normally, if the pandemic had not happened, we know the folks who are running for the state house, they would have been talking about education because that's an evergreen issue. That's something they can always talk about. They would have been talking about transportation. They would not have had quite the focus on economic development that we're hearing out of those who we are able to hear from. And we also certainly would not have been hearing much about public health. That's not something that is usually a real high issue when campaigners are out talking with voters. But right now, people do want to know, how would you have handled things differently? Do you think things are being handled well? And that's not just public health, but then it sort of has spilled over into this issue of rights and what can the government mandate in a time of what some people are calling crisis? Can they mandate wearing masks? If so, on what grounds can that happen? So it has definitely changed what campaigners, what folks are running for office and their volunteers and paid staff are talking about. But it's also changed what we as voters are interested in. And if we're looking for a silver lining, I would say part of that silver lining is that people have become much more informed about what governments do. Therefore, they want to hear more from candidates about what they are doing or what they would do. Unfortunately, the candidates have trouble getting out, talking with people, and raising the money in order to deliver their message.
Yeah. I know recently when Dr. Woody Myers, the Democratic candidate running for governor, was here in Northwest Indiana, he was, of course, doing the same things as he would normally do, the best he could. But he had a few talking points that he was armed with going into the conversation I had with him about the issues that Governor Holcomb has brought up in trying to deal with the pandemic and all of the, I guess, getting back open, back on track plan, as he calls it. And Dr. Myers had a chance to talk a little bit more detail about that, but he hasn't done much up until that point that I recall, other than just the general points, at least in the last conversation that he and I had, and that was with former State Representative Linda Lawson, who is now his running mate.
Yeah, it's been very rough for that campaign. They have not been able to raise a lot of money. When the last campaign finance reports were in, they were sitting on less than $1 million cash in hand, which is less money than the Attorney General, Democratic Attorney General candidate, Jonathan Weinsapel, had cash in hand. And whether you think Eric Holcomb has done a good job or a bad job, the Democratic candidate still needs money in order to get that information out, to make that pitch to voters. Unfortunately, today, $1 million is not going to go very far, especially when the incumbent, Eric Holcomb, was sitting on about $8 million at the time. So, you know, there was this incredible disparity in funds that were available. On top of that, there are a lot of people who were critical of the Democratic candidate for not being more critical of the governor in the early stages of what we're going through right now. I think it was going to be very hard for Woody Myers to do that, in part because people viewed what the governor doing, what the governor was doing, as fairly reasonable. But still, you know, he's a doctor. He is somebody who comes from a health background, a public health background, and was probably better situated than any other person in the state to be critical of what the governor was doing. But it was not something that we were hearing on a regular basis.
Now, how in general do you think that Governor Holcomb's handling of the pandemic has been, at least up to this point as we speak today?
I think there, as I always do, there are a number of ways to look at this. I think there are a number of ways to look at it. One is he has handled it from a technical standpoint. He's done what a lot of executives, whether that's a mayor, a governor, or the president, are told to do. Don't speak outside your realm of knowledge. Look like the person who is in charge and make sure the people who are working for you are getting their jobs done. And if they are not, then take some kind of action. So if you think about the briefings he's done, in many respects, they have been textbook, because he has deferred to the experts when it's been time to defer to the experts. Yet it's always clear he's the person who is in control, who's at the top of the hierarchy when you look at the meetings or the press conferences, the media availabilities. When you talk about how we have done as a state, there are a number of things that you could say, well, we did pretty well. When you look early on, we managed to start bringing down, to flatten the curve, so to speak, faster than others, and we're in relatively good shape. Now, we, of course, have seen that same sort of uptick that a lot of other states have seen, and this is maybe the moment when people could become much more critical, but still our uptick has not been as bad as a lot of other states, and it's been done in the name of trying to bring the economy back online. And let's remember, a lot of the folks who are being hit hardest by this economic crisis are those who are making low wages, and it's awfully hard to say to somebody who was, you know, making $8 an hour, $9 an hour, continue to sacrifice for the rest of us. That's a very hard sell. Now, someone could be critical and say the governor has not done enough to support them at a time when we need them to continue to stay at home from a public health perspective. And that's really the place where Democrats in general, and certainly Woody Myers specifically, should be taking advantage and should be bringing up on a regular basis, if not a daily basis.
Besides the pandemic that we're undergoing at this moment, we're also talking about Hoosier Politics with Andy Downs, who is the director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics in Fort Wayne. And with politics comes elections, and we know now the latest debate seems to be about the issue that we all went through in the primary election, which was voting by mail. And even the vice president stuck his toes in the water. He decided to go back into history, and he's gotten some flack about that, I understand.
Well, he has, and a lot of terms get thrown around, and unfortunately they're being used interchangeably, and they really should not. Absentee voting, in other words, voting by people who will not be present in their community on election day, has been going on for hundreds, or for decades. I can't quite say hundreds of years, but more than 100 years. It's something every state does. They know how they're doing it. We don't see much evidence, if any evidence of all, of widespread corruption. We do find occasionally that individuals may try to defraud the system, but nothing that would cause concern. There are five states that do vote by mail, which is not just absentee voting, but in fact everybody is sent an application so that they can vote by mail. And that's one of the places where terminology is getting misused, I would say, because absentee voting is not necessarily vote by mail in lieu of other methods of voting. In Indiana, we expanded vote by mail in the spring, and basically what we did was we eliminated all of the reasons that are listed in the statute for being eligible to vote absentee. In normal circumstances, I think it's a dozen different conditions that if you meet one of them, you're able to ask for an absentee ballot. If you're going to college out of state, if you're going to be in the hospital, if you're over the age of 65, things like that allow you to say, please send me an absentee ballot, fill it out, and you mail it back in. The vote by mail took away all of those reasons. So you could have a wonderfully healthy 38-year-old person who was going to be in town say, please send me a ballot. That's what people mean when they say vote by mail. It's what they should mean. Mm-hmm. There are some challenges there because in a state like Indiana, we're not used to the volume we had. And that slowed down getting election results out. But in the end, election results still got out. We are so used to results coming quickly on election night that if there is any delay, people begin to wonder what went wrong, where was the mistake, where's the potential for fraud. And if we went to complete vote by mail, certainly the results would take longer to come out, and that would give opportunity for those who think maybe they're not doing so well to feed the flames of conspiracies and other sorts of things, which then would result in people questioning the outcome of the race.
Do you think that, number one, if we're going to get the opportunity, that we'll have a vote by mail once again for the November general election? And if not, are we just going to see more problems ahead?
As it stands right now, it looks like we will not be voting, having that no-fault absentee vote. It does not look like we will go that way. The Republican members of the Indiana Election Division, or at least the one of them, has said he doesn't see any reason for it. The governor hasn't expressed an interest in it. We should remember that when we did this in the primary, two important things. Number one, you had the governor, secretary of state, and many other people saying we should do this. And number two, we had the fact that these were intra-party fights. Republicans, in many respects, don't care what happens in the Democratic Party, and Democrats don't care what happens in the Republican Party. So if there were disagreements or fights or, you know, questionable results, hey, that's the other party's problem, not our problem. That's the way a lot of people saw it. Now we're talking about the actual election. Who's going to hold office? And while people may have been willing to not talk about the challenges that come with voting by mail or large numbers of people voting by mail, they were willing to forgive those things in the spring. Now they want to talk about them. We are getting to the point where if the change is going to happen, it will have to happen soon because local election boards, local election officials need time to ramp up to handle what would happen if we went to no-fault absentee ballots.
I see a lot of people out there on Twitter supporting the idea of getting that absentee ballot in soon, because not only because of the fact that we may not have this overall, as you mentioned, the universal, so to speak, vote by mail, but the people are concerned about the Postal Service not being able to handle the load.
Yeah, and keep in mind, it's not only just the Postal Service being able to handle the load, and I think you know, we all need to recognize the wonderful job the Postal Service does, given the task they are given, the number of things that arrive on time, the unbelievably high percentage of effectiveness of what they do is really quite incredible. But we also need to keep in mind that votes need to be in to the election office by noon, not just by date stamped on the envelope, but actually have to show up in the office by noon. And so someone could mail it, get it postmarked at the right time, but it's not going to get counted because it didn't show up in the office by noon. That's a limitation in Indiana's law, a lot of people think, and one that they would like to see changed, just so that you are date stamped by the date of the election. That, of course, would mean even longer till we get to the final totals of the race. And there are all these little trade-offs that in normal elections, and I hate to refer to this as an abnormal election, but normally we don't think about these things because we know the results on election night. There aren't that many races that are that close. When they are, there's a recount procedure that plays out. You know, sort of used to all of these things, but now we're being forced to look at the trade-offs that are inherent to different voting techniques, different ways of counting the ballots, subtleties within the law, like the date and time by which a ballot has to show up, or when you could even start counting the ballots.
Well, as the tweets continue to fly furiously from the White House and other places, not only in Washington, but out of Indianapolis, too, we'll have to leave it at that for now. And, of course, there'll be more updates later. And, Andy, thank you for sharing that all with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Andy Downs is the director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University Fort Wayne. School districts across Northwest Indiana are making their announcements on how they are going to be handling the beginning of another academic year. Let's check in on another of the school districts here in Lake County. Larry Verocco is the superintendent of the Lake Central School Corporation, and he is joining us on the phone from the administration office in St. John. And Dr. V, thank you for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having us, Chris.
Well, bring us up to date specifically what Lake Central School Corporation is doing and how the community and how the school administration and the district in general is going to be handling another year.
Well, we're currently scheduled to start with parents having a choice whether they come in person or starting with the online format. And our first scheduled day is for August the 17th.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had made a recommendation and put it before the school board, which they didn't accept, unfortunately. What was that, and how did we come about now with the changes that are going to happen?
Well, we were interested in starting with a four-week period of e-learning for all to take a gradual approach, a slow approach, if you will, in light of some of the recent concerns from national experts that our Midwest states are becoming hot spots. And we also, quite honestly, thought it might be in our best interest to watch what the other schools downstate who have already opened, how is it going to work for them in the first few weeks? And so we were hoping to be able to watch others to see what actually happens when you put a bunch of students back indoors with teachers.
Mm-hmm. What did you discover in your research that you and your colleagues there in the administration building did at looking at other school districts, and particularly in central Indiana, that have kind of led at least to your recommendation, and what seems to be the thinking of the school board, at least to what they mentioned in public the other day?
Well, you'd have to talk to the school board about, what led them to make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
But, I think that, we had a lot of emotional people at our school board meeting, and, they made a lot of arguments, some that were facts-based, some that weren't so much, but certainly the parents of special education students made some excellent points about how ineffective e-learning is for certain children who need their teachers, and we recognize all that, and even some of the people who were emotional just because they don't like e-learning, I think it's important for us to respect those opinions as well. The key for us is, how do we do this safely? And our biggest concern really is how do we keep our staff safe? Because if we have staff members get sick and we have it in any significant numbers, it can disrupt our ability to do the whole process. So one of our motivations was if we do the e-learning, it might be inferior to in-person instruction, but it's something. And if we keep our staff all healthy, they can provide that something.
Mm-hmm.
By taking some risk, because we have a lot of staff members, they run the gamut from 22-year-old young kids to, old farts like me. And so the older you are, you obviously have the risk of having more severe symptoms, I believe. And that's anecdotal, too, by the way. But I do think that our concern really is if we start losing too many staff members, not only does it disrupt the in-person thing, but if they get really sick, they won't be able to do the online piece either.
Now, I know this came out after the decision was made by the school board, but we know that Lake County Health Department officer Dr. Chanda Vavilala had put out a new set of guidelines, updated guidelines, I should say, for school districts as when taken into consideration about reopening. In having a chance to you and your other colleagues, because you all got a copy of this and had a chance, I'm sure, to review it in plenty of time, what do you think at least this is going to bode well for the future?
Well, you know, the guidelines are helpful, and, you know, we've been asking for it since, you know, the middle of June, so we're happy to have something. The one piece of the guidelines that, you know, I think a lot of us are dubious about, and you're seeing many of, you know, our neighboring districts are starting on virtual learning, that the whole notion that students don't transmit the virus and won't get as sick. I mean, we've had some recent situations. You probably are aware of some Y camps, one in Georgia where after 4 days, I think it's nearly 75% of the students tested positive. So, you know, a lot of people are apprehensive that elementary children won't spread it to each other and or to staff members. But here's the thing. You know, there are a lot of people who want to be back in school. So the fact that a recognized health professional has said, based on these numbers, we think you can return to in-person as long as the community swirl, the community spread as measured by positivity rate stays below a certain percentage. That is helpful for us to consider. And, you know, we are going to have all of us, some of us will be in person and we'll gain information and data from that. And others will start on e-learning. And I think with the hope that those of us that are in person don't have any problems, that we don't have students or staff members get sick, and that allows more people to come back in person, which is everybody's preferred method. It's every administrator's preferred method. It's every teacher's preferred method. But, you know, as many staff members have indicated, you know, gosh, I think there's some risk here for us. There is some risk. Even Senator Braun in his interview on TV the other day, he's suggesting everyone needs to take some risk, okay? And it's just, we just need to be careful about being super confident about this young person data point. I don't think there's enough evidence in the United States of America of children being with students to draw conclusions yet.
A lot to, unfortunately, to consider behind the scenes, so to speak, before you have to bring things up in public. And it looks like that you all have done your research and continue to keep an eye on everything. One of the things I know as well, too, that has come out in recent days, along with all this, you had made recommendations about the sporting events that might be planned for the Lake Central School Corporation, and the changes haven't come about there. But we know some other school districts are opting out of the fall contact sports. Do you suspect that that may eventually be the same way for Lake Central down the road?
You know, it's hard to say. If you saw the headline in the paper, and I don't know who said it, I don't recall, but, you know, it does break everybody's heart to tell kids what they practiced for and what they love to do that we're going to suspend it for a period of time. And so I understand everybody's motivation to try to keep those activities in place. My recommendation to the board was just based on the fact that I think for us to get that community spread, that positivity rate down to a lower level so that the contact tracing doesn't become overwhelming, it means we all have to do our part and rein in our behaviors. It means people need to, you know, not go to indoor places where there's loud music so they have to scream at each other to be heard, because that has been proven to spread the virus. And we as a school system in the short term, I just thought it was in our best interest to not have those activities where students are in close contact, breathing heavily on one another. But, you know, time will tell whether or not we're able to carry out these activities without significantly increasing the spread of the virus.
Dr. Larry Verocco is the superintendent of the Lake Central School Corporation based in St. John, and thank you very much, Dr. Verocco, for joining us today, and we'll back in touch again soon. I'm sure there'll be more conversations going to have to come up as the fighting of the pandemic continues.
Absolutely, and Chris, thanks for letting area superintendents get some time on your show.
It's our pleasure. Thanks very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Coming up on Reporters Roundtable Thursday, we'll talk with the reporters who cover education beat for the local newspapers about their coverage in print and online of school re-entry plans, we should say, for the 2020-2021 school year. And we hope that you'll be able to join us for tomorrow's program.